The Thing, and The Mystery Menace. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, The Thing, alone against the Mystery Menace from Marvel 2-in-1 number 31, cover dated September of 1977. And Ryan, that's kind of a lie because he really finally teams up-ish with Spider-Woman here against the character we will actually treat as the guest star, the Mystery Menace herself, Alicia Masters.
The mystery is not so difficult to discern when you actually look at the cover and kind of like sets it out. But yeah, considering last month we kind of mentioned that it wasn't really a team up, it was a versus issue, it was Thing versus Spider-Woman. Now they're actually on the same side ish for a little bit.
And they still call it a versus. To my mind, this should have been like a two-part with Spider-Woman, or even the three-part, but with a Spider-Woman as the guest star on each cover.
Yeah.
But that's not the format they're going for, so this is what we get. It's a little wonky. It's a little wonky. But we should preface with a reason or reasons why we like the guest character. And in this case, we're counting Alicia as the guest character, even though she's a member of his supporting cast throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
So what's so great about Alicia for you?
I mean, it is the interesting play on the Beauty and the Beast trope, you know, the beautiful woman who sees love and something special beneath the monster's facade and everything like that. And maybe it's because she's blind, she can't actually see his monstrous visage. She's not distracted by his physical appearance, so she only sees the inner beauty. And I don't know if that was a novel concept when Stan and Jack came up with it, or if there was some literary precedent for that, or some kind of allusion that they were drawing from. I Stan certainly borrowed and lifted a lot of other ideas, but I'm not so sure where that idea came from. But I've always really liked it. Beyond that, though, because I didn't have a lot of exposure to her when I was first coming up in my early Fantastic Four reading, but when I went back and looked at the original Stan and Jack series, I was surprised at what a pivotal role she played in the original Galactus saga, because it was Alicia who played a pivotal role in getting the Silver Surfer to switch sides. She showed him the value of humanity and life on Earth and why it deserved to have another chance, and that's what got Norrin Rad to turn on his master. So in that sense, she wasn't just instrumental in seeing the beauty inside Ben, but the beauty inside everyone and the beauty inside the Silver Surfer. So she has this innate ability to kind of ground these fantastical characters, no pun intended, although kind of, within their kind of own humanity and what makes them human and special. And I think she just has that incredible talent, whether it's something innate to her or just kind of interesting fest of the writing. But she's a very cool character to have that ability that extends beyond just her boyfriend and now husband. And also, you know, just the fact that her stepfather is a supervillain. That's funny.
To answer one of your questions, Beauty and the Beast, you know, it's pretty old because it's from a 18th century French novel, yep, I think. Yep. And of course, the famous Cocteau adaptation of that in the 40s. And mm-hmm. even like King Kong is essentially Beauty and the Beast, right?
So Right. Yeah, that part, obviously, that dates back a long time. It was more the blindness factor.
I think that's the new tweak,
yeah,
probably, on this that Stan and Jack brought to the piece. Yeah, I had no real feeling for Alicia until she married Ben in the current era.
Yep.
And I love her in the Ryan North series, mm-hmm. certainly. Her superpower is kind of, it's basically empathy, mm-hmm. and bringing out the best in each of the team members. Sometimes they get paired off. It's like, okay, this bit is a Reed Alicia adventure,
yeah,
you know, for a couple issues, stuff like that. So Ryan North basically uses her as the fifth member of the FF, going out on those missions, kind of being a Doctor Who companion of sorts, who comes up with out-of-the-box ideas or gives exactly the right speech needed to make the heroes rally. So I really, really enjoy her in comics that are being published in the last like couple of years,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. for sure. But when you're reading her back in the day, you know, female characters in those old Marvel comics were very often, I don't want to say sidelined, because they were there and important, but they, you know, they were meeker let's say.
It was always an interesting dilemma with comics of that age, and certainly with Stanley comics. It's like, okay, he gives the female characters a degree of agency and credibility and personality, and then takes a little bit away. It's kind of like a, you know, two steps up, one step back type of thing. There's always a little bit of a cringe when he's writing, but yeah, there was a lot to like about Alicia from the beginning, but also those things where, oh, will her blindness make her helpless? And how much does, you know, Ben pine over that? How much of it is a disability or something that she has to overcome? Whereas over time, they're like, oh, it's not a thing. It's just, it's part of her, but it's not a thing.
All right. Well, let's talk about her publication history. So we've alluded to a couple of bits from it. Alicia Masters first appears in Fantastic Four number 8, cover dated November of 1962. She's a blind sculptor who turns out to be the puppet master's stepdaughter. And soon, because he's a human statue, she becomes the Thing's girlfriend. Despite that disability, her work was unusually lifelike, which she achieved, I guess she achieved only by touch or memory, because she had been blinded as a child, so it's not like she'd never seen. And fans have, of course, made a lot out of that one story where they put a wig on her and make someone think she's Sue Storm because they're so alike. I personally think it's a ridiculous idea to hold on to that notion and make some kind of psychosexual assumptions about Ben's or later Johnny's feelings. You know, it's like, let's forget about it. They're drawn the same because the same artist drew them. What's important is that she's not just a subplot for Ben, but frequently gets active in the Lee Kirby era. Even you mentioned the biggest example, she's the one who convinces the Silver Surfer that humanity is worth saving, though yes, often just a damsel in distress or driving the Thing's angst, though it's been proven several times that she prefers Ben as the Thing rather than as a human. The character is kind of in arrested development through the 70s, even if she keeps appearing in FF and sometimes in Marvel 2-in-1. After Secret Wars, Ben decides to stay on Battleworld, during which time Alicia and the Human Torch grow closer and start to date, eventually leading to a wedding in FF number 300, March 1987. Though, as Ryan will have to reveal, comics experts clock a certain change at FF number 265 3 years earlier. Ryan?
Yeah, well, after the Acts of Vengeance event crossover story, Alicia continued her semi-regular appearances in Fantastic Four. When Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan took over the series in 1991, however, they promptly revealed that Alicia Masters had been impersonated by a Skrull agent, thus undoing the, what I consider to be, ill-conceived marriage of Alicia and Johnny Storm. Throughout the rest of the 90s, she made a handful of guest appearances in Fantastic Four and other series like Strange Adventures and even the Mark Spector Moon Knight book. In 1997, Alicia started appearing in the Silver Surfer series, beginning a romance with Norrin Rad. She stayed in that book for 2 years until it was canceled. In the early aughts, Alicia didn't appear in much of Mark Waid's run with the family, but she did appear in a few limited series, including Fantastic Four 1-2-3-4, Marvel Knights 4, and The Thing. She was mostly absent from Jonathan Hickman's run on Fantastic Four and FF, but she did have one notable appearance in Fantastic Four 584, after Ben takes a serum that reverts him back to normal for 24 hours, he and Alicia are finally able to have sex. Of course, during that same 24-hour period, Johnny Storm is killed, proving that sex always leads to bad things. In 2018, Dan Slott took over writing the Fantastic Four with a series reset at issue 1, because that's how Marvel do. In his first issue, Ben and Alicia finally get engaged, and a few months later, they marry in Fantastic Four Wedding Special. In 2020, after the Empire event, Ben and Alicia become the adoptive parents of a Kree son and Skrull daughter, expanding Marvel's first family even more.
And she's a big deal in the current series, or the Ryan North series, which the second volume has started just recently.
And actually, I forgot when I was first talking. I think the first time she really popped on my radar was what I mentioned there, the miniseries 1-2-3-4 by Grant Morrison and Jay Lee. Because that was a miniseries where Dr. Doom has all these plans to like kind of hurt the Fantastic Four members individually. And by the end of it, Reed was like, okay, you underestimated. You thought my family was just these people, but you forgot that Alicia is part of my family too. And Reed has this plan that involves her sculpture, like controlling a Doombot type of thing that kind of undoes Dr. Doom's master plan. And I was like, oh, that was really interesting that Reed, of all people, would extend the family dynamic to include Alicia. I thought that was pretty cool.
And technically, maybe the story you mentioned where they first have sex, technically true, but I do remember a John Byrne issue where their minds are put into little tiny puppets of themselves.
Oh.
And they don't know they're not in their original bodies, but it does seem like Ben and Alicia are having a relationship. Although, maybe not, because John Byrne was very puritanical, actually. Mm. For all the sexiness of his stories and art. They're not married, so they're not doing it or something. Anyway,
right.
I think there was something like that.
Right. I haven't thought about their entire history enough to know that that was the first time they ever did it, but it was kind of interesting.
And of course, Alicia appeared a number of times in live action. Mm-hmm. She's in the Roger Corman unreleased FF, played by Cat Green. She's in the 2005 FF franchise, played by Kerry Washington. She was sort of replaced in the new FF movie for reasons. Now, let's get into this issue. My Sweetheart, My Killer. It's written by Marv Wolfman with art by Ron Wilson and Sam Granger. Ben and Spider-Woman make friends as her memory starts to return, and they can't find where Hydra took Alicia. Instead, Alicia finds them. Except she's a killer spider monster controlled by Hydra. One that Ben is loath to punch. By the end of the issue, she's knocked Spider-Woman out and has Ben caught in her web. Meanwhile, those lovable fortune hunters, Chauncey and Trevor, have finally assembled their map and are close to the treasure hidden under the House of Commons by Chauncey during the Blitz when he was, gasp, a Nazi agent.
Ooh.
Yeah, I feel like I gave too much of the synopsis copy to these guys, but... Yeah, it's going to pay off eventually.
I would argue Marv Wolfman gave too much of the story to these guys. But we'll see.
I think I probably agree. But we'll get into it. Let's look at that cover by Ron Wilson where the Thing is in the shadow of a spider monster, mm-hmm. shocked. He says, Cripes, it can't be. They changed my gal Alicia into that? Blowing the spoiler on Mystery Menace here.
Right, right. I like the cover. I wish it included Spider-Woman because I like Spider-Woman and I always want to see more of her. And because she is part of the story as kind of a team-up. But I do really like this cover. I think the look of palpable horror on Ben's face is really striking, like bug-eyed, mouth agape. And like the fact that the background is all white, so his word bubbles are in purple or kind of magenta, it looks like on my digital cover. But yeah, he's like, they changed her into that, and we see a shadow of what is obviously a spider shape, so we kind of know what they changed her into.
It just spoils the mystery that they're supposed to be, you know.
Also, my sweetheart, my killer, I mean, there are a few options of who else that could refer to.
Thundra! Exactly. So it's amusing. That's how it kind of resolves. But it is a quirk of the team-up format. They didn't want to do the same guest star twice. I've seen this happen a couple times on team-up books where they go like with a mystery guest. It's like, well, right. Isn't the name of the person, of the character, more attractive to readers than the mystery of who they might be? Is that an indictment against the character? I mean, if they'd put and Alicia Masters... That would be a non-seller, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, there's Action Comics when it was Byrne doing team-ups in Action Comics, and they did like a mystery Superman and who knows? And there, you couldn't know who the guest star was without explaining away Superman's ghost.
Mm.
But it turns out to be, it was a shape-shifting hero. I'm keeping the secret. The shape-shifting hero, you know, masquerading as him to confound the Silver Banshee in her first appearance. You know, there are reasons to do it. But if you're going to spoil it on the cover anyway, I don't know. Like a part two Spider-Woman would have probably worked better here. Let's get into the action. It starts with, we already have Spider-Woman knocked out from the explosion at Big Ben, and they're underwater. Hydra is on the surface looking for them. Spider-Woman is knocked out. Ben has to swim and save her. Already we're switching sides here.
Very heroic right off the bat, saving her from drowning. We get the Hydra foils, which are branded. They have the Hydra logo on there.
And Hydra foils, yeah.
Yeah, Hydra foils. Gotta love the alliterative name, Hydra foil. Just because I have G.I. Joe on the brain, having recorded recently with Brett, and as of the time of this recording, we just had an episode of his Fantastic Poor show drop yesterday. Yeah, I had to compare this to the Cobra hydrofoil from the G.I. Joe toy line, which was vastly superior to this one. But again, this was done for, what, 3 panels total, and it's done.
Hydra's not really working in secret as much as you might think. They got branded boats. Also, let's say the splash page, right on top, Stanley presents the thing alone against, and instead of saying Mystery Menace, against the woman he loves. So if it wasn't clear before, you know, it should be clear now. And Ben does that thing where he grabs the hydrofoil by the struts, the ski struts. And I love how it's like cracking the hull.
That's a cool detail.
Can't take the pressure. Mm-hmm. So he's not just holding something as if it were weightless. It's you know, its own weight is crushing the hull. So that's pretty good. And then he throws it. Do we see... Oh, the next page you'll say they jumped out at just the right minute, but you don't see it in the art. So it does look like Ben is murdering those guys.
It's fine.
Well, there's dialogue to fix it. So I always feel with the Marvel method that, you know, by the time it comes back to the writer's hands and they have to script it after the art, a lot of the dialogue is meant to fix what the art isn't showing.
Right.
So Marv is going, Ron has drawn the thing, outright killing 2 Hydra goons, probably 3. There has to be a pilot in there. So let's have him say, they made it out.
Lucky we're on water. The fire wouldn't burn them up. Yeah, something.
You know, we do have a flashback again to Spider-Woman's origin, just how she got into Hydra's hands. And from there, we'll jump to the subplot you want to read about, the Chauncey and Trevor looking at maps. Let's talk about that subplot, because it's going to come up over and over, and let's just do it in one go.
Yeah, please.
What are you thinking at this point? About these characters. They've been around for what? Like a couple issues already.
Yeah, I guess it was just the last issue that they introduced them, but they took up so much space in that issue. So yeah, they've been planting bombs all over London, and when we see them now, it's like, okay, the last bomb that they planted, you know, like, now they've got, like, all of London and all the authorities scrambling to see where the next location is, but Chauncey's plan is, well, that last bombing was the site that they have to go to. That was where the treasure is. So we're going to go there now that nobody is paying attention to that site because it's already been targeted. I'm like, okay, that's clever. It actually reminded me of the plot of Die Hard with a Vengeance. That was a Jeremy Irons plot, like something like that. He set off a bomb near the Federal Reserve and then had all the cops and everybody scrambling to other places, ignoring the Federal Reserve, and that's where he ended up targeting. But so that kind of, I was like, okay, that was kind of clever. I like that. This is doing something. And then Chauncey starts spinning a tale of how this treasure map and the treasure they're seeking came to be. And with each new detail, I found myself thinking, you are making this up as you go. This does not make any damn sense. Like, why? Every detail is like, this is sus. I'm not sure about this. But yeah, ends up revealing that he was a former Nazi agent. It has to be one of those things where he's like, this one Nazi stole this treasure and that guy was me. I am like a... But he's like, he also has to say, you know, I didn't really care about the Nazis' plan. That wasn't that, but... It's like,
But he was in the SS, they say.
He was in the SS.
So,
I don't think they just let casuals join that group.
So he's got this treasure map that he made himself. Like, he has to find all the pieces.
And that's the thing. Like, a treasure map, like, that whole concept dates back hundreds, maybe thousands of years when you didn't have normal landmarks. Like, you didn't have, like, other maps. It's like, yeah, you needed a map to say you go... you know, 100 paces towards the sun and then turn at a big rock or something like that. Like, pirates needed treasure maps because they were just at the ocean and everything looked the same and they couldn't tell one island from the next. When you're in a city with street names and buildings that you recognize, and also you're planning this treasure for yourself, you don't need a map. You can just go back to the spot where you left it. And, like, why did he wait so long? Like, how long did he think he was going to have to make? Like, all this whole thing is like... Why did you make a treasure map for something you buried and you plan to unearth underneath a building that anybody can find, like, recognize? Like, it's not hard to find.
Like, I understand. After the Blitz, they rebuilt part of the city. Mm. But they didn't have to rebuild Parliament or... You know, like the places that he actually goes to, you know, Tower of London, and those places survived the war. So, yeah, it's not making a lot of sense. We'll say at this point, it's possible that there are explanations coming, because at the end of this issue, the Spider-Woman Hydra plot isn't over. We're getting a third part of that.
Right.
Which means these guys are going to be in the background of the next issue as well. And it's still not going to be important until the next issue after that.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. So we might get other explanations. I will say I like the detail on page six where Trevor, the other guy, is looking over the plans with Chauncey. And he's drinking some wine and he's like moved his hand to let him unfurl. And it's like there's wine on the floor and... That's an interesting detail that we didn't need necessarily. It's like, I guess it's like he just unfurled the map and was like, okay, let me move this glass. And it was too full and it shows maybe how venal these guys are. I don't know.
Right.
It's an unscripted detail that I think Ron Wilson isn't just phoning it in. Let's get to the real plot then. Hydra has Alicia in a machine. They've got a big serum that Dr. Court has created for them. They want to replicate the Spider-Woman experiment. It's all going to go wrong in a way. meanwhile, our two heroes are trying to, they go back to that first Hydra base that Ben demolished with Shang-Chi. And of course, it's not there. And he's just trying to make Spider-Woman maybe recall, you know, it's like maybe something will flash. But it's quite the big rampage scene for Ben.
I like the ramp up to this even like before, like when he first brings Jessica, Spider-Woman, onto shore. His previous experience with her, they were fighting to the death on top of this building. And he's like, look, tell me where my girlfriend is. Or he says something like, I don't want to rearrange your face, but I will if I have to. He's threatening to get violent. And then when he kind of sees she's disoriented and she does it, she's like, no, I'm not under Hydra's control again. He instantly becomes sympathetic and his compassion wins over. He's like, okay, look, I need your help. You're obviously... you know, in a state, so let's get some coffee in you, let's give you a rest to catch your breath, and then talk to this. So I like that he's able to change based on who he thinks he's going. If he has to fight for it, he'll fight for it. Once he sees Spider-Woman isn't the danger to him, isn't the threat, he's like, okay, kid gloves, let's approach this. I need to coax some help out of her. So I like the way he's handling that. And then, yeah, when they get to the previous base and they're looking in, she's like, I can't help you. This was my only clue. You see he's physically shaking in those four panels across the center. His fist starts to ball, and he actually sheds a tear from one of his eyes. And then the rage just rips up the floor. You get the rip sound effect.
He's eating cables.
He's cable. He's tearing this thing apart with his teeth. I like that detail.
It's an amazing, like, it's a two-page sequence. It's emotional. It's there's big action. There's Kirby tech all around.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of even a little absurd. I like that you talked about Ben's motivation for the team-up and for the reconciliation here. What do you think of Hydra's stated motivation on the previous page?
I like that all of the Hydra goons shout the same things in unison, like they shout it together. But that's usually like one or two words, a simple phrase like Hail Hydra. This is almost like their pledge of allegiance that they're all shouting together. Hail Hydra, immortal Hydra, we shall never be destroyed. Cut off one limb and two more shall take its place. We serve none but the master, as the world shall soon serve us. It's like, they're shouting all of that? Like, they've rehearsed this or something? Like, are they harmonizing? Like, that's a lot for the whole group to shout together.
I mean, when you think about it, what their leader is saying is that what they really want to do is save their base from being closed down, right?
Yes, they're fine. It's like, this is...
They could have staged a show. In a movie, when you don't want the store to be closed down or the school to be closed down or the department to be closed down, you stage a show. And they got the Hydra choir right there.
Yes.
They could have done something, but no, we're going to make a spider monster instead and then prove to the master somewhere, you know, Madam Hydra, whoever's in charge... We'll show them that we're still relevant.
We're trying to avoid the layoffs.
Would there be layoffs? I mean, once a Hydra, you're always a Hydra, aren't you?
I'm just like, what would the Hydra equivalent of the movie Empire Records be?
Exactly.
They have to get the Hydra band up on the stage on top of the store.
Oh, gosh. Our heroes are leaving the first Hydra base, the destroyed Hydra base, and it just pops out into the street, right? There was a restaurant on top or something. Immediately, when they get out of there, they are attacked by a spider creature that is Alicia.
That's a cool splash page.
The look, I really think that the look could have been better. Couldn't they give her like some sort of leotard or something, you know?
Yeah.
She's just in her ripped up clothes.
I think part of that is this was not the experiment that they wanted. Like, this was not what they designed it to look like. So had they maybe been planning on giving her something like Spider-Woman's costume, but she's more of kind of a were-spider in a sense, although she still has all of her humanoid limbs, but she also has the 8 extra arachnid legs kind of jumping out at her. Her hair is all kind of crazy in a tangle and possibly a different shade than it was when she was captured. And her eyes and mouth are all kind of deformed in this sort of monstrous, almost vampiric look. So it's a striking, kind of terrifying look to her. But yeah, it's not, you know, by design, this isn't a character that they need to ever bring back. So it's not like they needed to design something special for her. But
and she's kind of hairy as well. And they put a little bug on her forehead, which acts as a camera that they look through, but also that allows her to see. So, yeah. So you've created this tech. You kidnap somebody who is blind to be your super soldier. We laughed about this last time. That it's not necessarily the best subject.
Right. Not to sound ableist, but I mean, just...
Yeah, you're building a super soldier, and your formula is not going to give them... You know, you're giving yourself problems.
Right. There were other people in London that you could have picked from.
Exactly. Of course, if they already had this tech, I guess it's not a problem. Oh, we'll just put our little sight bug on her forehead. And I also felt at that time, I was like, is it also like a bit of... That's what mind control... That's how they're directing her, so that chip does a lot of stuff. And Ben is very conflicted, you know? It's like, can I be punching my girlfriend?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, yes, she's been transformed into a monster, but she's not the real enemy. So it creates an interesting dynamic where she fights both the heroes. Spider-Woman is quick to fall.
Yeah, I guess I would chalk that up on Ben's hesitation leaving Spider-Woman vulnerable, but yeah, she is dismatched very quickly. As far as team-ups go, Spider-Woman didn't really offer a whole lot in this issue.
No, I mean, cool visuals.
Yeah, again, I like the costume. I've always liked that, but yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's furious action, and it shows that whatever they created, Hydra, they created a fiercer, perhaps more powerful monster than Arachne ever was.
Right.
And then there's this, this wonky, in terms of physics, wonky moment where, okay, well, Ben is also being trounced by Mystery Menace, and Alicia throws him at what we're going to say is a runaway lorry.
Yeah.
Just the way it's portrayed.
Yeah.
He gets thrown into a truck. He blasts through that first metal wall of the back of the truck. Mm-hmm. And then the next shot shows that the truck was actually moving.
Yeah.
But it was not put off course by being hit by the thing. It's still moving forward.
Going through several walls.
Yeah, into a department store. It's quite the sequence. The physics don't work. Mm. But I see what they're trying to do here. Because he's in that truck. It doesn't tip the truck over when he gets thrown at that speed. And then she jumps into the truck, even though it was moving. And the fight continues inside the lorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty crazy. And then, that's going to cause the department store to almost tumble. Ben can't fight the Mystery Menace because he has to save the people in the store from it crumbling. He's holding on to supporting beams, saving a little kid. And that gives Alicia the chance to grab him from behind. I say there's a web there, but it really he's in her spider legs.
Right.
As we go to cliffhanger.
Yeah, and Spider-Woman kind of woke up and she says that she's going to help. So we get another bit of her hopefully coming to his aid in the next issue. We also get one more quick scene with Chauncey and Trevor into these lower catacombs below the building. And then he's like, they shoot a guard. And he's like, I don't know what he was doing here. It's like, he's the guard. You're breaking in. What do you mean? What was he doing here?
Yeah, this is an old subplot, eh? It feels like it's heavy padding. Yeah. It's also the old school comic book scripting, because right. I remember when one of the biggest examples for me has always been Len Wein's Blue Beetle.
Okay.
It was mid-80s, yep. But yet in this style. And he had running subplots all the way through. And it's like that technique where there's a main plot, there are B and C plots, and eventually the B plot becomes the A plot, or the C plot becomes the B plot, and things become... There was one of these with the guy who became Carapax, I guess one of the villains in the movie. The guy who becomes Carapax goes to Pogo Island, where Dan Garrett had been killed, and I think he goes there like in the first issue, and it only resolves in the 12th issue.
Wow.
So there's a little page. There's like a page of Pogo Island every issue for months.
Yeah.
For a year until Len finally resolves it. So I think that's like an extreme example. But this subplot with Chauncey, and at least they intersected with Ben in the previous issue. Otherwise, it's like, this is just taking us away from the fight that we want to see.
Ultimately, I liked Ben's hesitancy to engage with Alicia. Like, he doesn't want to fight her because, despite her monstrous outer appearance, he knows who she is inside. He knows that she's his love and this beautiful one inside. And I felt like that was almost kind of a reversal of their relationship, where she sees the wonderful man in the decent man inside of him, despite his rocky exterior and everything. And then this is kind of the thing where now she is the monster. She is the freak, but he knows who she really is. And he sees the beauty in her, and he doesn't want to fight her that way. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Great point. It's a role reversal for them, or maybe they could be a couple looking like this. Like, if she's not under mind control. All right, who fared better, Ryan? How well does this fit each of the character stories or atmospheres? Is this a Thing story, or is it more of an Alicia story, or is it more of a Spider-Woman story?
Definitely not the latter. It's a Thing story. It's all about his pathos, his desperation to find the woman that he loves when he thinks she's been taken, she's been lost. And then when he's actually confronted by her, can he fight her? How can he save her? It's all about his emotional state. And Alicia isn't, first of all, she has no agency of her own. She's captured and then she's turned into a monster who, for all intents and purposes, might as well be a different character. And she's not like any way recognizable as the Alicia we know. So yeah, I think it's a Thing story, and nobody else would even come close.
All right, well, I have to agree with that. What about cool moves? What is the Thing's coolest move?
He's got a couple. I certainly like when he starts tearing up the room because he's so upset. But I like when the truck gets crashed through the buildings, and he has to actually like get out and hold up the support beams while people are evacuating. That's one time where he's focused on saving lives instead of fighting, and up to the point where there's actually like a little kid in the way, and he has to get that kid out of harm's way. And that's what allows him to actually be captured by Alicia at the very end, or caught in her web/legs. So the fact that he was prioritizing saving the innocent people, I thought was a nice trick that you don't see enough in a lot of comics like this.
Agreed. Although in my case, I will go with eating the Hydra base.
Ripping the pipes up with his teeth. That was good.
a very thing to do. What about the guest's coolest move? I mean, it could be Alicia's, it could be Spider-Woman's.
I mean, Alicia, Ben grabs her from behind, he's got his arms and legs around her, and she flips him forward, so she's talk about some leg strength and some leverage. That's a nice move.
I like her fight with Spider-Woman. She goes snicker-snack, catches Spider-Woman between her stingers instead of outright stinging her. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a pincer movement.
Yeah.
That looks very cool. But she's nearly unstoppable anyhow. You know, like, it's the same. When she throws Ben into the truck, the arms go snicker-snack in the same way that her spider legs did. And it pushes them super far. So she's a powerful monster in this. What about dumb or weird moves? Any for the Thing?
I didn't really have a dumb or uncharacteristic move for him. I think like everything he does is logical and like in character, and nothing's really suspect. But I guess the closest I would come to would just be the criticism would be he doesn't get even a small win. He's not really proactive. Everything is about him missing her, searching for her, being frustrated that he can't find her, then being attacked by her and not wanting to fight her, and then being caught. And it's like he's always on his back foot. He's always on the defensive, and we don't really see him get a good moment, a real heroic moment, I think.
Yeah, I suppose if he had been, like, I think he rolls with the punches and he doesn't actually do any bad moves. But if he'd been more proactive, more clever, he might have tried to stop that truck somehow before it hit the building.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're inside the truck, like punch your feet through and break it or something. It's like he can't stop any of the problems from mounting. Yeah. What about Alicia or Spider-Woman's?
Alicia's dialogue, once she's transformed, once she's brainwashed by Hydra, everything she says is just kill, 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 or kill Grimm, like she's, like, is Hydra controlling her voice, too? Is the, like, are they telling her, okay, you have to kill Grimm, and then she's just repeating that phrase out loud?
But I guess.
Like, that's just, every line, she's just, kill Grimm, until, like, the last page, just, die Grimm, die Grimm, die Grimm. It's, all right, calm down.
Calm down. Yeah, I already mentioned how I hated the look. Not the monstrous look. Oh, I'm seeing on the last page there, her feet are really creepy too.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's fine. But I think she should have been in a little more of a... They should have put something on her because it's just like a ripped up shirt, looks like a bra, and like she's in a skirt. I don't know. I thought Hydra, you're building some sort of super soldier. You got something.
Yeah, she could have been like a green Hydra jumpsuit at least. And then that could have been ripped up, but something recognizable that they had some forethought. This is why their branch is being closed down.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe like a green version of Spider-Woman's
outfit
or something, you know. Oh, well. And then, I mean, if we want to say Spider-Woman has bad moments, she gets owned pretty quickly. What about that unfriendly farewell that is Ben's team-up tradition? Well, we're trapped in an ongoing story.
Right.
Ben doesn't actually get any goodbyes. But if we treat the last panel as such, his relationship has seen better days.
I think they can work this out.
And this is a question that's going to have a wonky answer because we usually ask, if this were your introduction to the guest star, in this case, Alicia Masters, would you want to read more stories about her? Would you have you wanted her to become a new Arachne, for example, and kept on going maybe as a hero?
No, I would not.
No.
This wouldn't intrigue me to want to read more stories of Alicia like this. I like okay. Alicia the way she's supposed to be.
Okay. All right. We'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit... I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, spinning out of Hawk Angel's already legendary Hydra storyline, Alicia Hall has been gifted, or cursed, with the hero's DNA and turned into a weapon. The winged menace is half bird, half woman, and all danger. For Hydra, that is. They created a monster, and that monster is coming for them. This Step Never, a new era begins for Amalgam's Monster Comics. Don't miss it.
We're back. Our monthly feature, as you know, is the bonus team-up in which each of us proposes, well, in this case, a perfect Alicia Masters team-up. So I have to be imaginative here, Ryan.
This one took me a while. Like, of all of the team-ups that we've had to do for the show, like, this one, I probably spent the most time thinking about. And I was like, okay, do something obvious like Alicia with Batman and, like, have something to do with, like, the blindness and the sonar abilities of bats or something to do with that, or just, like, have her, because she's so good at bringing out the humanity, she just brings out some levity in Batman and it doesn't take it so seriously. But ultimately, I wanted to go with something bigger. And in the spirit of this issue, where she's transformed into a monster and she gets in a fight with a thing, and there's a lot of craziness about this whole story, I was like, all right, let's really go out. So my team up is Alicia and the Female Furies. And this story would be just a celebration of Kirby Crackle, where the Fantastic Four travel to Jack's fourth world and they see the New Gods. And Alicia is captured on Apocalypse and she's brainwashed by Granny Goodness into becoming the newest one of her Furies. And her warrior name is now like Pygmalia, because she has the power of like creating like little statues or golems that she then controls and uses as her little army of fighters. So something along those lines. And then I really just use that as a setup to get for the next part of that story. The part two of that story would be the Thing and Orion just cutting loose in the Armageddon.
Why not? She used to be the Silver Surfer's girlfriend as well. So there's a cosmic connection, thanks to Kirby. I did do a Batman thing, but not the Batman thing you were talking about. It's Alicia Masters and Gilda Dent. So Marvel DC crossover like yours between sculptresses.
Yeah.
As the only people who can stop an alliance between Puppet Master and Two-Face. I throw in cutaways of the Batman family and the Marvel's first family. To show why they're not there, but it's basically two perfectly human, famous, well, semi-famous in the case of Harvey Dent's ex-wife, I guess. They're both like, you know, comic book sculptresses, so.
I like that. I wanna
rock! As usual, we're riffing on Ryan's deep interest in music. I hope you've been listening to FW Records. And we bring you his musical selection to go with the comic, and it's guest star. So what were you listening to while reading this comic?
King off of the Mystery Menace. I keyed on that word, mystery. And there were a lot of different songs with that reference. Trying to maintain my pattern of finding music that was contemporary or at least preceded this issue so that it could have been a soundtrack to this issue when it was originally published. So it had to be before the mid-1970s.
Right.
And I ended up settling on the song She Is Still a Mystery by the Lovin' Spoonful. And she's still a mystery to me. I thought I'd grow up gracefully. I'd understand my woman thoroughly. But the more I see, there is to see. Some people might know them as the band from Woody Allen's What's Up, Tiger Lily, although they did have a couple of other really good hits. Cool band. I actually like a lot of their stuff. This song came out in 1967, and beyond just the title, She's Still a Mystery, there's a line in the chorus where, the more I see of her, the more I see there is to see, or something like that. And I just, that idea of kind of like, again, with the cover of this issue, with Ben looking like terrified at the sight of her, the more he sees of Alicia, the more he sees she's become this horrifying monster that is attacking him. So it was just kind of a little bit of that idea that I thought was fun.
A good selection, I think. Amusing. Mm-hmm. And you can, I mean, there's a little, there's an extra layer in there. We're talking about sight in the song. We're talking about, obviously, that mystery. We're talking about their enduring love as well. It's like, I mean, he's still with her.
Yeah.
To this day, you know, he eventually marries her and the relationship only gets deeper. So these are two people who have gotten to know each other. You know, it hasn't resulted in any kind of boredom. I mean, with that kind of life, maybe boredom isn't going to happen. But they never got sick of each other. Or maybe if they did, eventually they got back together.
Also, one of the founders of the Lovin' Spoonful was Canadian. Just for you.
Thank you. I feel so proud and patriotic. Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel 2-in-1 number 30, starring The Thing and Spider-Woman, part 1. I'll start with Brett Young here, first out of the gate. He says, great show. And then he says, Ryan, I'm a big Tom Jones fan, too. He did a song collaboration in the late 90s with Moose T called Sex Bomb That Kicks Ass. So he's sending back musical recommendations as well.
Well, Brett, if you go back to the Secret Origins podcast and the episode I did, I think it was the annual with the Teen Titans that I did with Tom Paneris, Chris Franklin, and Hub from his podcast. I believe that Moosty Sex Bomb song I used in the closing credits, or that was the outro music for that episode. I love that song.
Oh, wow. Okay, great.
I think I used it just because Hub said that Aqualad's hair, Garth's hair, looked like the Tom Jones perm.
Good enough for me.
We've got a comment from Nate the Great, who said, I think the villains in this are both ableist and stupid. Agreed. And I don't even know what you're talking about. Now, grabbing Alicia could have got them beat up by the whole FF, after all, not to mention Spider-Woman and Nick Fury. Yeah. I mean, we kind of brought up that point. Like, you just need a test subject, any test subject. Don't grab the one who's going to draw more ire and more threat to you. I don't.
Nate, you're mentioning, you know, the whole FF. Well, get a little bit more of that next time. Bucky749 has a Spider-Woman Star Trek crossover idea that you'll find at fireandwaterpodcast.com. I don't read them all because it becomes very long when we start doing like everybody's team-up ideas. But it's a good reason to go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and check out the comments section, because there's a lot of fun ideas there.
Martin Gray said, I liked the original Spider-Woman series a lot more than you chaps. The Wolfman issues were solid, the Claremont issues great, and the Grunwald issues outstanding, especially the Necra fight issues. We shall not speak of Michael Fleischer. And lots of good art from Carmine Infantino and Steve Lealoa. Again, I read a lot of those issues and I liked them, but it just felt really inconsistent to me. But again, I didn't read all of them, so maybe that had something to do with it. Anyway, Martin continues, okay, I'll give you Trevor. We had a few Trevors around in the 70s, but Chauncey? Never in my life have I met anyone called Chauncey. No one has, outside of Edwardian fiction. And then Martin says, mind, what really annoyed me was Marv Wolfman having Ben make a gag about IRA bombings. Not funny. Understandable. Yeah.
That's a British a British take, yeah. I got to ask Martin, is Chauncey actually, well, we find out here, he was like a Nazi agent, so Chauncey's probably not his given name. But is Chauncey a nickname? Is it like a Charles, or is it like, is anyone called Chauncey on their birth certificate? Or is it something like Bob for Robert or Dick for Richard, or is Chauncey something like that?
Yeah, the only other context I remember hearing Chauncey is almost sort of a derisive kind of like almost adjective for, or something like kind of like a snooty or pompous highfalutin type of person or something like that. Like,
yeah.
And then Martin also says the cooking is terrible in Britain. Now, Siskoid, we can't all come up with gravy and cheese curd, which he loves, mind you. Again, a stereotype from the West, certainly from the United States, that's perceived that food in England is terrible.
You know, kidney stuff and too many entrails. And I think France is the same. And you know what? I'm in a glass house throwing stones. I come from a country where it's all based on starch.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sean is next here. I believe it's probably Sean Ross. Says, by the time I started collecting comics, Jessica was depowered. I liked her as a hardscrabble private investigator in her appearances in Wolverine and X-Men, but I much preferred Julia Carpenter as Spider-Woman. However, Bendis' revival of Jessica in New Avengers made me love the character, and the solo series by Dennis Hopeless and Javier Rodriguez was awesome. I'm all in on Jessica now. And I agree. I'm of that generation. I think that's how I watched the cartoon. Obviously, I knew like a Spider-Woman in costume. Mm-hmm. But by the time I was reading comics, she was already depowered. And that didn't stop me from liking her and then following her to later appearances, like he says.
And I think I mentioned this last month, too. I don't remember. But I discovered the Julia Carpenter version first, probably through a trading card. I hadn't read a lot with her, but I always loved her costume. I like the black and white look of her suit. But yeah, once I actually got to know the characters, I liked Jessica a lot more.
Yeah, the cartoon predates anything for me, but Carpenter was the first in comics. I mean, I was reading Secret Wars. I was reading X-Men when she joined Freedom Force.
Right. Paul Kane, also from here on the network, said, I enjoyed the 50-issue run of Spider-Woman when it came out, but I agree it was hampered by creative changes. The late career Carmine Infantino didn't help when I did a reread a number of years ago before getting rid of the issues. Great show. One of the reasons that Marvel 2-in-1 was so great was the continuity. Here was an early example of it, even though the story in this particular issue wasn't that great. And I think you could say that about this issue that we just covered, too.
Yeah, the arc could use some pruning.
Yeah.
Tim Price says, I wanted to do a read-through of Spider-Woman Volume 1 last year, so I started with her debut and these Marvel 2-in-1 issues, which made for a great reading experience. I could see all of the good and bad turns for the Dark Angel, and boy, there are a lot, but a fun wild ride. I even rewatched her animated series a couple years back just to see how much I remembered. Almost nothing, that's how much. And count me in as another listener who was glad Bendis brought her back and seeing it stick.
And Rob Kelly, also from here on the network, said, growing up, I always sort of assumed Spider-Woman was a top-tier character. But in retrospect, I realized that was mostly because of the cartoon and her inclusion in the big two-page Clark Bar contest ad and other ancillary merch. Then a little later, she got a full-page house ad to herself. So Marvel was definitely giving her the full court press. I've always liked her power set and look, but her significance to the MCU was mostly illusory during those early years. And when he says MCU, I take that he means the Marvel Comics universe. However, I first read that as Marvel Cinematic Universe. Which brings me to this thought. Siskoid, I realize now as we're about to end this episode, this is the first one we're recording since Fantastic Four First Steps came out.
Correct.
Thoughts on the movie?
I loved it. To me, like the whole homage to Kirby that's in there, that he appears in, like, first of all, it's, you know, it's the Fantastic Four, etc. But they do a lot with it. There's a small cameo by him and Stan or characters that could be them. But it's also just like the Roz character.
Natasha Lyonne's character.
Is obviously Roz Kirby.
Oh, I didn't. That's what, yeah, I knew that. I knew there was some significance to that. I didn't realize that was, yeah, okay. Okay.
Yeah, you know, then he meets her, he goes at a school, he goes to a synagogue, and why isn't it Alicia? You know, that's the question. Why isn't it Alicia?
They're saving that for the future if they need to, yeah.
So the names, etc. And so Ben, which we've always said was a Kirby insert.
Yeah, yep.
So Ben has this flirtation or whatever we want to call it. That's very sweet with her. And so I felt it was like Kirby all over in this. I like the changes. I like that it was like a one-off piece that you didn't have to watch any of these stupid Marvel TV shows. And it didn't introduce characters that have to pay off in like 10 years or anything like that, really. And it had its own world, which was fascinating to look at. You know what? It was like it came out 2 weeks after Superman.
Yeah.
And it gave me the same vibes where it's fun. They throw in a lot of stuff, you know, Mole Man, and then just like name other people, the Red Ghost, and we just jump into it. No explanations, very quick on the origin story. It's not an origin. And everything that the other FF movies did badly, which was we start from the beginning, they all hate each other, they don't know how to work as a team, and at the end, they finally work as a team. And they went to that well a couple times.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was terrible. So let's start later in their timeline. And we just jump into it, just like we did with Superman. Mm. And the audience can catch up. We've seen so many superhero movies by this point. So that movie really spoke to me. And at this point, it is my favorite film of the year.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
That's awesome. That's what I talked a little bit about this with Chris on the latest episode of Nightcast. I really, really enjoyed it. And I said, it is the Fantastic Four movie that I have wanted for over two decades in a lot of ways. I thought Sue was fantastic. Like, I didn't know a lot about Vanessa Kirby, but I thought the way they wrote her, the way she performed it, she was amazing. I was really impressed by Human Torch, who's a character who I think often, for me at least, I kind of forget about. He's just kind of like the fourth, you know, most significant character because he's a lot of flash, no substance. But I thought Joseph Quinn did a great job. He was interesting. He was fun to watch. He had a good side story of his own.
Smart.
Yep. Yeah, he was. Reed, I thought this was clearly the best Reed they've done on screen. There were a few things I could have had them do differently or better, but for the most part, it was great. Ben was great for what he did. He didn't have as much to do. I don't think the story like gave him much more to do. I didn't like the Rocky beard. I didn't like him growing the Rocky beard. But as a family unit, I liked their scenes together. I liked the way they were together. Yeah, and you hit it, and I didn't even think about that. But yeah, we didn't have them be like fighting and at each other's throats at any point during this thing where they have to come together. No, they are together. That stuff they went through any, you know, backstory. They know who they are and how much they care about each other.
They made it about family.
They did. They did. They really did.
It was their family, but also like the Silver Surfer saved her family. Yep, yep. It was all about family, especially the pregnancy and all of that. And they got it right that Invisible Woman is the leader of this thing.
Yeah, she's the heart. Yeah, I think I mentioned also, like, I love the Silver Surfer character in the comics. I'm a big fan of Norrin Radd. So their decision to change that to Xia Bao, I wasn't really looking forward to that. And I was wondering if that would kind of, okay, you're finally doing Galactus right, but you're doing Silver Surfer wrong. But that wasn't the case. I thought Silver Surfer was fine. I thought she looked great the way they used her powers. She didn't have like a whole, I mean, she had enough of a character arc to give her some substance, but I think they've also done this character in a way that if they want to do more Silver Surfer in the future, they can use her or they can do Norrin Radd.
And great surfing.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Like the entire, I told Chris, the whole middle chunk when they go to the planet, they see Galactus for the first time, they have that encounter, and then when they're trying to escape and she is chasing them, the surfing, the fighting with the ship as Sue's going into labor, and they're like, you know, having to like bounce around, use the gravitational pull of the black hole, all of that stuff I thought was like the best action sequence I've seen in a while. I love that part. Yeah, all in all, like I really, really, really liked the Fantastic Four movie, but I was also left kind of thinking, why couldn't we have gotten this movie in phase one of the MCU? Why couldn't we have gotten this in 2008 or 2009 or something like that?
Copyright problems.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know the reason why, but my brain just can't help because now I'm like, I like this a lot more because it wasn't tied into the baggage of the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now, because I'm less involved in the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now. I don't care as much. So
which I think it's too bad that it's like their next appearance.
Right. When it said they'll be in the next Avengers movie, and I'm like, oh, okay.
And then if they do like let's combine all the universes as we think they might after Secret Wars.
Yeah.
What does that mean for this really cool version of New York?
Right.
Well, you know, Fantastic Four 2 with the Dr. Doom, Franklin kind of storyline that is teased at the end there, which does not seem to connect to the Secret Wars Avengers thing, or the what might, I don't know. If there's a Fantastic Four 2, it's not going to be in this cool world. I feel like the future is kind of sketchy at this point, but this one piece, I loved it.
Yeah.
And maybe I love it because they did the Fantastic Four so badly in the past.
Yeah. Based on what we got from this movie, I mean, forget whatever they do with Avengers Doomsday or how they reset the world, but based on this movie, I want to see this cast, this director, this screenwriter, this like production style, with a proper sequel, take them to the negative zone and have them fight Annihilus. That's what I want next.
The trilogy that I always wrote in my head when I was watching those terrible movies,
yeah.
I would have done the negative zone as the stand-in for going to space.
Yeah.
In the modern era. So you fight Annihilus.
Right.
Maybe Blastar as a sub-villain.
Yeah. No, definitely. I would have the same thing.
And Doom, it might maybe an ally. Mm. He's not yet Dr. Doom, or he's in the background. So you don't bring him right away. Then the second movie, you finally bring out Dr. Doom, which seems to be what they're going to do. And then in the third movie, you would have done Galactus, Silver Surfer, and Doom steals the Surfer's powers. You know, it's right. Like they seem to collapse too much of that in like a single first movie.
Yeah.
But that's how I would have stretched it out if I had done those other franchises. What they've done here, hopefully we're entering an era of fun superhero movies as opposed to dark and dreary superhero movies.
Yeah.
With these two last, you know, hits.
Right.
That we've gotten from each of the comic book universes. Anyway, fingers crossed. All right. Well, thanks for teaming up with me, Ryan. You want to tell people what you're working on at the moment? I think you're one of the network's workhorses at this point.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was about 10 years ago, and I feel like now I'm back there. I got a couple of shows working on. Chris Franklin and I are doing Batman Nightcast again, which comes out every month. By the time this episode drops, I believe I'll have restarted Cheers Cast Season 9, which should come out 3 times a month. And then on months with a fifth Thursday, plan is for me, Max Romero, and Paul Keane to drop new episodes of The Sandman Slept Here, which is part of the Justice Society Presents feed. And when I have the time, me and Neil are going to do more episodes of Fire and Water Records, so... And now apparently we have to do a G.I. Joe podcast too, so.
Great. A reminder that we do have a Patreon. So if you like this content or Ryan's future content, it's all the same place.
Yeah.
If you want more like it, please think about making a monthly or a one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts. Best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Ryan is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with Bass as we continue our coverage of DC Comics Presents with issue number 11 of that series. So on that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team up, because after all, justice
is a Chauncey effort.